Deborah Cleland works in science communication and fisheries conservation. Her PhD looked at whether interactive games can help us manage human environmental systems better and more justly. Deborah's latest project has her playing computer-assisted board games with small-scale fishers and other interested bystanders. And this is done to attempt to understand and promote community support of marine conservation in coastal communities in the Philippines. Deborah also co-convenes and blogs for the Human Ecology Forum at ANU. How did your interest in science begin?
Okay, science begins. So it was along a circuitous route, and actually my interest in kind of working in this space between science and society happened as an undergrad. So I did undergraduate degrees both in science and in arts, and I was doing a lot of human ecology and natural resource management sustainability type courses that were explicitly dealing with this idea of interdisciplinarity or transdisciplinarity and trying to bring together these seemingly really disparate fields of kind of pure or hard science or ecology, those kind of things, which some would think of as a soft science, but still definitely in the science realm, and some of the social and political sciences that a lot of people are starting to realise that we really need to have a good grasp on if we're going to start turning around some of the trajectories that we're seeing in the natural world and in the ecosystems that support or underpin human survival on planet Earth. And it was in this context that I kind of stumbled into work on a World Bank project, a World Bank and Global Environment Facility funded project that was working on coral reefs. So it was a global project called the Coral Reef Targeted Research and Capacity Building for Management Project. And they had centres of excellence across the major centres of coral reefs in the developing world. And the idea was to build capacity across major areas of knowledge, like knowledge gaps and kind of areas that needed support in those regional centres. And I started working with a working group for modelling and decision support, which is a really interesting kind of configuration because there's an implicit logic there that says decision support, i.e. making good decisions about how to manage our environment, involves modelling. And models, again, feel very much, computer models fall very much into that realm of hard science, mathematics, physics, linear or even more complex relationships, but ones that aren't really subject to much theorizing or kind of alternative epistemologies that you might be expecting from someone who is kind of coming from a social science-y background. And so you immediately kind of think, well, where are the people in computer models? Are they being modeled? Have we become automatons inside those systems? And is that the most important thing? So if we think about coral reefs, it's really good to understand fish and polyps and tides and connectivity between reefs and all that kind of thing, which is science. It's getting on your scuba gear and it's checking out these incredible ecosystems that are just so beautiful. They're just sublime in their beauty. But if we look at what we know about the reefs and what's happening to them, it's people's behaviour. It's causing the problem. So you can think about them kind of as the four horsemen of the coral apocalypse, and that's climate change, ocean acidification, overfishing, and issues to do with coastal development. So if it's human behaviour causing the problems, then it's human behaviour that you need to target.
Yeah.
And that's not rocket science. It's something that people have been saying for decades now. But the issue with working in this modelling and decision support space is it's like, where are the people? How do you incorporate them explicitly in this kind of working group world that says we need to build models? So we're people with tools looking for a problem, basically. And I was really lucky that the people who were working through the ANU on this project had very similar ideas about the need for participation, the need to incorporate people, the very great importance of people being involved in the decisions, the management decisions that will be made that would potentially affect their livelihoods and their safety and security. So we basically were building ecological models that have spaces for humans where humans play themselves inside that model. And that's a kind of a logical step, if you can see it, to games from there, because it's kind of how humans in groups are almost used to interacting in imagined scenarios. So if you can think of something like Monopoly,
yeah,
good example, where we're kind of taking on a persona, we're taking on a role and acting on an imaginary world in a way that has consequences for ourselves and for the people around us and the environment, in a sense, because you're building up your houses and your hotels or whatever. So that was kind of the original ideas that we had about building models that would have people as their central focus, and real people, not just kind of modelled people.
I think I remember seeing some of the work that you've done. It seemed to be implying the tragedy of the commons is something that people still need to reflect upon and be engaged in order to understand.
Correct. And it's particularly pertinent in an area, in the ocean, which is an area that is kind of inherently ownerless.
That is
a commons. It's very hard to put jurisdictions, to have tenure, and those kinds of mechanisms that we often think of as being quite effective in regulating access and control and some of those perverse outcomes that come from a common scenario as originally described so long ago. So yes, exactly. So we were developing these games, and we've developed two that end up kind of being a commons game, a fishing game. And we actually first started in Mexico, so I now work in the Philippines, but learned a lot from our kind of aborted experiment in Mexico, actually, where it was very much more a regional approach. So you can think somewhere like Cancun has got incredible problems of coastal development, where that was a tiny little town towards the end of the 80s, like 100,000 people. So you're thinking something that's even way smaller than Canberra, where I'm from, and to reaching about a 1 or 2 million population by the end of the 90s and 8 million visitors annually. That's in just such a short amount of time, this incredible population impact, and it spreads outward from that tourist centre, and has had a really devastating impact on the reefs there. So we had a game that looked at that, look at tourism development as well as the impact that that had on the fisheries and livelihood displacement. But as it turned out, a lot of our social assumptions were really wrong there, and some local anthropologists basically said, you cannot think about the socio-ecological system here without incorporating the drug trade.
That it's
basically acting as a perverse influence constantly on the market and the actions of people in that area, so that to not have it is to not understand the system. And that was a really important lesson that I think has been learned again and again and again with people who are working in development, so essentially working remotely from the communities which they would like to have an impact in, whether remotely, culturally or physically. And just said, okay, we can't do it like this. We've got to be actually working with local people, local scientists, working a lot more closely with the different players that have the capacity to affect decision-making and achieve different outcomes in the areas that we're hoping to have an impact in. So that's when I moved to the Philippines, because we just the Filipino marine scientists have incredible relationships with the local government units, which are the unit of government that has jurisdiction over most of the reefs out to about kilometres out. And so since then I've been working in this kind of fishing game space to try and look at if this gaming approach and try to mix it up a little bit in terms of the stakeholders, all these different power groups and interest groups, as well as here's the different issues in terms of not only the ecological degradation and that scientific basis of understanding the way that reefs work, but also the poverty and the disempowerment and the other problems that come along with an overcrowded, overexploited resource. And I often get to this point because people get really excited about it, you know, Kylie, like they go, oh, that's really cool. And you think, yeah.
It's so complex though. Yeah, it's incredible.
And often these changes take a long time. Yeah. And so what you get with a game, I think, sometimes is really great photo opportunities, and kind of an opportunity to open doors and to create connections between people that perhaps otherwise wouldn't occur, but that kind of getting excited in and of and around the game only is also, you're kind of on a hiding to nowhere. So that I like to be kind of creative and passionate about using like these visual tools and games and things that are really interactive that encourage participation and encourage relationship building across different sectors, but also to kind of stand back and with look at a critical eye with how much you might be playing into stereotypes found assumptions and looking for quick fixes where actually slow, boring...
takes time. It takes a lot of time and effort, yeah.
Might actually be more effective in the long run. So it's for the research, I think, it's about kind of drawing a balance between selling it as a success and dismissing it as a failure.
Mm.
And work kind of different stories around that and how we can maybe use those to understand how interventions, kind of science meets practice, interventions can be done in a more effective way.
Now, at Science Rewired, you're going to be talking about gaming for good, very much what you've been discussing there about how looking at destructive patterns of behaviour can be turned into real change for people and nature. And you're also going to be talking about citizen science is not a viable means of undertaking research and whether or not that's a myth. Have you got any teasers about what you might discuss?
Well, if for the first or the second?
Oh, either. What
either, either.
Because obviously you've got lots of ideas and
yeah,
things to tell us.
Yeah, and I think I'd really like it to be something quite open. I think it's really important. I take a lot of inspiration from a book called Teaching from the Back of the Room, which is about running adult education workshops, and which basically says get everyone to start with what they know. Mm. And so for everyone to kind of bring that knowledge to the table. But I think encouraging people to explore that positive, enthusiastic, creative, let's stir things up side of using gaming as a way of engaging with really complex environmental and scientific issues. And on the other side going, wait a minute, what are we really trying to achieve here? What is our communication goal? How are we trying to manipulate things? Who has power? Who's speaking? Who's controlling? What goes into this mix and what does that mean for the outcomes in the real world, if there in fact are any, which we're hoping for in something like Gaming for Good. And then hopefully people will also get to have a bit of a look at Reef Game, which is the main tool that I've been using that I developed as part of my honours thesis, and then it's been taken up by an ecosystem-based management tools group and also by the World Fish Centre as a kind of a tool for encouraging discussions and negotiations around issues of sustainable livelihoods and coral reef management across the Philippines. And then citizen science, I think Kendall kind of sprung that one on me.
Oh, good. And, good challenge then, yes.
It's really fantastic because I feel like I'm the citizen in this and not the scientist because most of my research is more in the social science sphere of things, using science and using science communication, but really the analysis and the data is really sits quite squarely in the social science realm. So I think I thought immediately of my experiences with ABC Sleep Survey, which I've done twice now, and how wonderful it is to feel part of something that's bigger than yourself, that where your knowledge, your expertise, your time is valued and goes into something that could provide really valuable information for something that's as basic to everyday function as sleep. They've got a hearing survey out at the moment, a major kind of countrywide hearing survey, which I also did. I think it's every time that you do something like Frog Watch, which I've done, or kind of ecological restoration at a local level, that's you taking your skills as a scientist and as a citizen and bringing them together in a way that's really empowering and can do nothing but good for the institution of science, people's understanding of science, their appreciation for what it can offer, decision-making processes, and also what it can't offer, what it can't do, what it can't be expected to do. So around areas of uncertainty and measurement where I think people have struggled understanding it until they're the one going, well, how long is a piece of string, or whatever the scientific question they're being asked to engage with as a citizen is. And so that the lessons or the importance of citizen science may not reside in how accurate are the measurements, but more importantly in what does that mean in the broader sphere for how we engage with science in trying to decide how our society should be, how to improve the way we interact with our planet, the way we interact with each other, the way we treat our bodies and our families and our houses, that kind of thing, our built environment, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Lots of things to talk about. It'd be brilliant. Cool. Thanks so much for talking to me, Deb, and looking forward to meeting you at Science Rewired.
Yeah, awesome. Really looking forward to meeting you, Kylie. Take care.